Accession number 26599, a real two.
Which is, I think, exactly what was happening. That however hard I tried to make life normal for me, I had had such a severe illness that my system really wasn't ready. And so there was a terrific battle going on inside me, which got focused into my nervous system. Largely because the meningitis had attacked my nervous system, which is where it goes. And so I was sent back to King's College Hospital with these fits and given intramuscular injections to stop them. And it was recognized that I must be discharged. So I was sent to a gulag. A military psychiatric hospital in Sutton, in Surrey, which had been a lunatic asylum, but was full of servicemen. The bed space in my ward was about 1 foot, because D-Day was bringing stuff in all the time. There were no glass in the windows. They were largely boarded up. The male nurses looked like they should have been patients. The punishment, if you did anything wrong, was to be put to sleep for a fortnight in a black room. And so I did my best. When my parents came to visit me there once, they were so horrified, they thought they were going to have to get the local MP onto it, but I didn't want any problems. And we got up at about 5:30, well, we got up and cleaned the ward, and by 8:30 you felt that the day was over. Well, of course, it had just begun. It was dreadful. But I was determined not to show any symptoms because I wanted to get out of there. And it was the only way that I could be discharged from the army. And eventually, I was before a discharge board, and my discharge was given. But it was a horrific place. I remember there was near me was a man from civil defense who, in the middle of the night, would suddenly wake up and shout unspeakable obscenities and just wake up the entire ward. And he was there because he'd been sent out one night from civil defense on a bombing raid, and he'd been sent to a block of flats where his mother was found by him dead, and he was put to sleep for a fortnight. There was a parachutist from the parachute regiment who I knew very well, whose parachute had failed to open until he was about 200 feet from the ground. And he was right round the bend, as you can imagine. He also was inside for 2 weeks. Not as punishment, but just to try and calm him down. It was a nightmare. It really was like a Russian psychiatric prison. And so I got my discharge.
I mean, were you ever sort of seen in a thorough and proper medical context?
No, not at all.
Psychiatrist?
Not at all. No, no treatment whatsoever. It was just a path to discharge. Eventually I saw the man who wrote Battle for the Mind, who was called, whose name was Sargent, actually. Dr. Sargent.
Yes.
I know his, John Sargent?
I know of his films.
Yes.
He made some films.
That's right.
Some of his treatments. Yes.
Well, he was responsible for discharging me. He was a kind man. After that, I needed to work. How's the watch? Should we stop?
Just
yes?
John Krish, Real 2. John, if we could just go back to Pinewood and the Army Film Unit.
Yes.
And really talk a little bit more about the atmosphere there. what perhaps, if it ever existed, what a typical day might have been like. Just to try and create for the listener the sort of ambience.
Yes, sure. Well, it was like Dad's army in a way. It was a joke army in Pinewood. It had the trappings of discipline. That is, we had a morning parade, a roll call. We ate in what was the canteen there in the old days, which was run by the army, I seem to remember. And then we dispersed to our cutting rooms. A typical day was very much like a studio day. A lot of chat, idling around in corridors, getting on with it when we had to. As I was saying before, the question of rank simply didn't arise because the man who was running the unit was a major, but everybody called him Hugh. It was Hugh Stewart. And before that, it was David MacDonald, one of our worst film directors, I have to tell you. If you've ever seen Bonnie Prince Charlie, was it, who made? It was unbelievable, but very sweet man, but absolutely hopeless director. Anyway, they were very nice people, and perfectly aware that it was no use coming the old soldier stuff and pretending that they were in the army, because although we wore uniforms, and although we slept in what were dressing rooms and become small barrack rooms, we were only kind of army on parade and before breakfast, and some PT, which was reluctantly taken. Oh, dear, to the despair of everybody in the RESC who was trying to organise us into being proper soldiers, which was ridiculous. The same was true in the Air Force and the Navy. And we intermingled. There were dances, the entertainments, and the play that I told you about. The thing about living at Pinewood was you had to get a pass to go into Uxbridge. The place was surrounded by barbed wire. There were guards, armed guards. In my barrack room, I don't think there were more than kind of four or five of us, two of whom were brothers. They were projectionists in the Army Film Unit, but they had been at the Ritz Cinema when Gone with the Wind came out. And their greatest achievement in life, and I don't exaggerate, they told me this. They said they never need to look at the screen for the changeovers. They knew the film so well they could do it blindfolded. And that, they thought, proved that they were top projectionists. That was the limit of their horizon. They were very sweet men. I think they were called Bill and Alf, and I came across them in Water Street when we rolled back in civvies. It was a happy place. It really was.
Are you aware of the comings and goings of the cameramen who actually went out?
No. Very occasionally one was aware that they came back to England, but they didn't seem to come back to Pinewood for some reason. One of my... No, I can't remember. No, one of the very first films I went away on during the Battle of Britain, when I was in the Crown Film Unit, we were a unit of three in those days, the director, the cameraman, and me, assisting both him and the cameraman. And the cameraman was Skeets Kelly, who then was in the Air Force Film Unit and had the rank of flight lieutenant.
Yes.
Very sweet man. He was killed later. He was, I think, taken a prisoner. But, I mean, he was Skeets. I couldn't call him Sir, and he didn't expect to be called Sir. And it was very strange. It really was. I mean, nobody really knew. I mean, the only thing to do was to get on with it and to relish the informality.
So, for example, you worked in the cutting room, so who would bring the film to you and explain what it is, and how would you
Well, there would be dope sheets. And there was a supervising editor who would have been responsible for that side of things, of saying, cut this, no doubt. I don't actually remember the process. But there would have to have been a supervising editor, because the cutting rooms, because the True Glory covered all the services, there were Air Force cutters. In fact, the man who produced the play I was in was a sergeant in the Air Force. He was an editor I knew. And the Navy had their own cutting rooms. The Americans' army was there as well. So when you walked in the corridor and talked, it was very lively. And I'm sorry that I can't remember more of the organisation.
No, not to worry at all.
It was very informal. And busy. We worked very hard. Although I say, talk about being in the corridor, and that's the nature of editors in cutting rooms. They tend to want to chat a lot. But they get on with it when they have to. The trouble is keeping people out of your cutting room while you're working. If they've got nothing to do, if they've done their bit, they'll come and want to chat. And that's that you had to be firm about. I was probably the youngest one there.
Did you feel that you had a flair for editing?
Yes, I did. Yes, because I was very musical, I think. And because I came to reckon editing to be the second best adult game. The first one is obvious. I mean that. I had no wish to be a director. I would happily have been an editor all my life, but circumstances were forced on me later.
Yet you worked as an assistant director.
Oh, yes, yes. But just to see a film come together and to be on a film from start to finish was, and to see it evolve and to make it better and to just to create something was, it suited my temperament. And I've always busied myself in the cutting room, even when I became a director. I couldn't keep out. It's something that those of us who've done it will want to go on doing it, not leave it to somebody else. Strange.
Can we go back to your discharge now?
Yes.
And what happened at that point?
Did you actually leave
the filmmaking side at all?
Not at all. No, I went to the Office of War Information. An editor who I had assisted in the Crown Film Unit was there and got me an interview. And the man who interviewed me was a very dear American, the shyest American I've ever met, a man called Montague. I cannot remember his first name. But he was the makeup editor for Paramount News in America. Incredibly experienced man. And the OWI, the Office of War Information, was the American equivalent of the COI, or the MOI as it was then. And they were making a weekly newsreel from combat material of the American forces.
Sorry, where were they at this stage?
They were in Mount Street in Mayfair. And when I went to my interview with Montague, Mr. Montague, in typical American style, his feet were on his desk, his hat was on his head, there was a fag in his mouth, and being an essentially polite man, a sweet, polite man, he didn't know what to do first, to take the feet off, take the fag out, take the hat off, and we just hit it off, and he employed me as an editor. And the editor who I assisted was in one room, I was in another. In another was the editor who had cut the Blue Angel, an American. We were working with very inflammable material in those days, and he insisted on smoking in his cutting room, if you can believe it. But we made this weekly newsreel. And we would see rushes in negative, because there would never be time to make a print. And Montague, I wish I knew his first name.
There was an Ivan Montague.
No, I know him. No, he was a Soviet Ophile. Yes, no, I knew him. We would sit in the theatre of about four editors that were there at that time. And we see all these rushes, and Montague had the experience to be able to say, you will take this story and it'll be 132 feet. You will have this one and it will be 183 feet.
This is the cut story.
Yes, we were told in advance. He would just look at the rushes and know the length of each story. So we knew how long it had to be, or how short it had to be, and that it would make up a 10-minute reel. I mean, he was a phenomenon, this man. And so cutting in negative taught me a great deal. It taught me to be clean, to be tidy, because if you make the wrong go, that's it. You know, this was precious material. And we worked extraordinary hours, and they were incredibly trusting. If there wasn't any material in, and there was nothing for us to do, or nothing for me to do, they would say, don't come in. But if it came in at 7 o'clock at night, they would send a car. And if I was there until 3 o'clock in the morning, there'd be another car to take me home. And that's how it was. And I had an assistant, who then left, and then I had another assistant who turned out to be the accountant's girlfriend, who was utterly useless and lazy like you cannot imagine, and I displayed a cruelty towards her which I really didn't know I'd got. It was very hot one afternoon. Oh, one of the things that's really pissed me off was that she used to type letters while I was at the Moviola. And I don't know how many times I would ask her to stop. Or then say to her while I was cutting, am I disturbing you? I would say that to her in heavy sarcasm. Didn't get through to her. And then one day when I was going down, we were at the top floor, the cutting rooms, they always are, of course, like six floors up. And I said, I'm going down to have some tea, you're coming. She said, oh no, I'm so tired, I don't feel like it. So I said, well, throw yourself out the fucking window. I mean, and she left happily. And then I was promoted in a way from doing the newsreel to doing documentaries. They wanted a documentary about the Philippine invasion, and so I was given that material to turn into a three-reeler, which was a wonderful thing to be able to do.
Is this because they were sort of more Eurocentric in the sense that they were based here? Rather than cutting it in the States and sending them across as...
Oh, I think they wanted newsreels every week in the occupying towns, you see. And it made better sense to have it centred here. It was very efficient. Very well done. And we were never late with the reels. But then one day, after I'd done this Philippines stuff, one morning in rushes, and we had no idea what we were going to see. There was just a dope sheet that only had one word on it. And we were sort of looking at the screen, and suddenly it's nightmare time. And we look at the dope sheet, and it says Belsen. And this was the first material from the liberation. I'm not sure if it was Belsen, because my memory is slightly askew here, whether the Americans actually liberated Belsen or another one, but it was the first...
It's the British that liberated Belsen.
Oh, well then...
So the Americans were Dachau.
Then it's Dachau I'm talking about, yes. It said Dachau on the dope sheet, because it was the first concentration camp that had been liberated. And so we're sitting there for 3 hours. So we're talking about this morning, sitting in the theatre in Mount Street, not knowing what we're in for, what we're going to see, with just the word Dachau on the dope sheet. And it's the liberation of the camps, of the camp, by the Americans. And we sit there for 3 hours and see this stuff in negative. And nobody could say a word. Nobody had any idea of what had been going on. There had been no information coming out about death camps. We were the very first to see it on film. And when the lights went up, nobody could move, nobody could talk. And the first words came from Montague, the head man. He said, "None of you must say a word about this. You mustn't speak about this to anybody." And I suppose the reason for that was that the Americans, with an eye to the future, didn't want to upset the Germans in their forthcoming Cold War with the Russians. That's my feeling. You know, they didn't want to rock the German boat.
So you didn't use this material at all?
Oh yes, it was cut. I fortunately didn't have the job of cutting it. But it was never shown and never talked about until much later. And it was an experience that there are no words to describe it. You know, you can throw harrowing out the window, you can throw shock out the window, there are no words. It was just unbelievable, nightmare. But in negative, there was an eeriness to it which is not there in positive film. So when the war was over, when the victory in Europe was done, they were going back to America because they were still at war with Japan and there was no point in keeping a London office. And they threw a party. They didn't have any food. They only had rye whiskey. They had no ginger ale. And I got so smashed that from that day, which would be 1945, would it not?
May
1945.
Yes.
God, I'm so pleased you're here.
Yes, yes,
May 1945. I had to be carried out of the cutting room to a taxi. And I think from that moment I had alcoholic poisoning, because I've really never had any amount of any real amount of alcohol ever since. After that, I had to make my own living in the world of documentary in Soho, which was a very busy area.
Because you are already a civilian at this
stage. Yes, that's right.
So
yes.
Dewalt didn't come out as you were.
No, I was in 1944. I was wearing the suit and the hat, which we threw out the window and from the train, I seem to remember. The suit was as if it was made of cardboard. It was quite extraordinary.
I wonder if this would be just an ideal place.
Yes, sure. Because we've hit Civvy Street.